ever feel stressed out? Well, of course you do. Most people do, at least from time to time, feel a bit of stress, anxiety. Maybe things build up in life that make it hard to execute your work, to enjoy things, to do much of anything. And when things change, especially when they change suddenly, well, that can add to our stress. Of course, as an educator, you know this. You have enough stress in your life already, but the strain of remote and hybrid learning, the sudden changes there, and the uncertainty associated with education right now, well, that's adding to stress for everyone. Educators, administrators, faculty and staff, not to mention parents and students. Of course, one of the best things to do when you're feeling a little stress or anxiety or frustration is to talk about it. So this week in the EdTech Club, we're talking about student anxiety. We're talking about using social-emotional learning, and we're talking about neuroscience. Our guest speaker is Noelle Foy. She's a former educator and now consults about neuroeducation, that is, using neuroscience to improve educational outcomes. She's going to talk to us about things to keep in mind as we approach change, as we recognize stress in our lives and the lives of our students, and what we can do about it. It's a big topic, and it's important for just about every educator. And that's why I'm glad you've joined us for this meeting of the EdTech Club, because we're talking about these important issues, and it all starts right now. Hey everyone, welcome back to another meeting of the EdTech Club, the podcast from TCEA. I'm Andrew Rausch. As I said, this week we're talking about stress, anxiety, the changes in education and how it's affecting students, and how educators can respond. So that's the buildup. Let's get into it and have our guest speaker, Noelle Foy, introduce herself.
So I began my career as a classroom teacher. And then I was a learning specialist for about 25 years, and then I became a neuroeducation consultant about 10 years ago. And this happened because one of my sons suffers from post-concussion syndrome, and this got me to a lot of brain conferences, and I just learned so much about the brain and the impact that stress has on learning that I realized this was something that every parent and teacher and student needed to know. So it got me thinking about my own kids. I have four sons, and it got me thinking about how they love learning, but they didn't love school. And it got me thinking about when I was out doing school observations of classrooms that I was noticing more kids that were either acting out or zoning out. And I was seeing more of these behaviors. So it got me more thinking more about stress and the impact that stress was having on my own kids and other students. And so that kind of changed the career path that I was on, and I became a neuroeducator, really started paying close attention to the brain and how the brain likes to learn. And then I started designing and delivering workshops for parents and teachers and working one-on-one with students, kids and adults, about how to decrease stress and boost learning and performance. And then I recently became an author of the book ABC Worry Free because I was really concerned about the increase that we're seeing in anxiety. And I really wanted to respond to that with a relatable story, but also with an actionable strategy that you could use in real time when you're feeling stressed or anxious. And this could help bring that stress level down so you'd be in a receptive state to learn and get be able to push through those difficult moments.
And over the past few years in education, of course, we've seen a focus on social and emotional learning. This almost seems to take it perhaps a step further. So you talk about neuroeducation, just from glancing at that word or hearing it, neuroscience being the science of the brain, education being education. These make sense together, but we might sometimes kind of think of them as separate fields or somehow siloed off.
When you talk about neuroeducation, if I'm a fellow educator, what does that mean to me, and what are you trying to get across with that term?
So it's a great question. Neuroeducation is a collaboration between neuroscience and education, and it's interdisciplinary. So it's including cognitive neuroscience and psychology, neuroscience and education. And it's about using those findings, the latest findings in these fields about how the brain likes to learn. And then what I do is I transform those findings into simple practical applications for the classroom, for the home, for jobs, for sports, all different kinds of situations. And I do that by helping teachers design their lessons in ways that will lower the stress but keep the learning high, and also help with some instructional practices that can decrease stress but better engage students, decrease behavior issues, but really boost the learning and the performance, because we know that when stress goes up, learning goes down.
You began to approach neuroscience because it had a presence and a cruciality. It was crucial to your life, personally, and you began to learn. So now that you brought these things together, what are the takeaways? What does neuroscience bring to the table in our understanding of learning?
Oh my goodness. So many takeaways. I would say the overarching one is we can learn how to stress less and learn more. And I'll just elaborate on that a little bit. So we know that there's a connection of emotion to learning. So the brain likes to learn when it's in a calm, focused, happy state. Sometimes it's very stressed. And when it is, this can block learning. So if a child or an adult is in a state of frustration or fear or anxiety, frustration, boredom, or even lack of relevance to what they're learning, this can make for like a virtual stop sign in the brain that can block learning. And when this happens, the stress response is activated, and this can block learning. And in these moments, our executive function skills go offline. And these are the skills that we really need to get started on a task, to stick with it when it gets really difficult or challenging, and then to complete it. And we need those skills working for us. And when we're stressed, those are not available to us. So let's say, for example, in the spaces that we're in right now, that a tiger walked into your room and a tiger walked into my room, our stress response is going to be activated. And in those moments, we're just going to be trying to survive, and we won't be receptive to taking in this information that we're talking about right now. And what's happening for a lot of students and adults too is they're feeling stressed to the point where they're not remembering what they just learned, or it's getting in the way of their ability to make decisions and to really think clearly. So it's really important for teachers and parents and students to learn some strategies of how they can try to elicit a more calm, focused, happy, emotional state. And ways I do that is by some low threat, high learning engagement strategies, and bringing in some novelty and collaboration and music, movement, and humor, and some fun into the learning, because we know the brain likes those things, and that will boost the dopamine, like the happy chemicals, and that will open up more opportunities for learning. And if we can cultivate psychologically safe environments, whether it's on distance learning or in a traditional classroom, where kids feel valued, safe, respected, feel that they can trust those around them, this is really going to create more opportunities for learning. And setting achievable challenges is important. Not too hard, not too easy. And for some kids, the information's coming in a little too fast. We call that cognitive overload. We need to have some scaffolds in place for them. And the interesting thing, Andrew, is this is typically not part of teacher training or parent education. So a lot of parents and teachers might be wondering why their kids aren't remembering something they just learned or were just taught, or why so many kids are acting out or zoning out, when in actuality, it might just be that stress response doing its job.
Yeah, and I feel like we know this almost colloquially or in a common sense way in our daily lives. We know that when our work or our responsibilities become overwhelming, cause us stress, it becomes harder to execute the things we're supposed to do, right?
That's right.
And so when we think about, I mean, the word even stress, again, it's a word everyone uses quite often. But I'm thinking in neuroscience, it has a more specific meaning and one that might give us an idea of what stress actually does to our minds and our ability to work.
Yes, well, it definitely affects our ability to take in information. It affects our ability to remember information and to access that information. So if we are learning something, we want to be able to retrieve that information later. But if we're stressed, we're going to have a hard time doing that.
Right. The tiger is sitting in the corner of the room while we're trying to have the call.
That's right. And the tiger in those moments is the priority, because if we think about, you know, the stress response and students going to fight, flight, or freeze in real time, that can look like a student who's maybe combative or perhaps is saying something nasty. Or you might have a student in flight who is trying to escape the room or is asking to go to the nurse or the bathroom multiple times. Or you might have those kids in freeze that have that deer in the headlights kind of look, or they just put their heads down in the desk and play dead. So we can see in real time these behaviors that let us know that the kids are in fight, flight, or freeze. And in those moments, they're not learning.
Right. You mentioned, you described it as like a roadblock, a barricade. You have been so distracted by the priority, by the thing you're afraid of failing or not going right or being held to or whatever it is, that executing the process of simply thinking, retaining information, that becomes the challenge.
Exactly. And the brain becomes so filled with, let's say, those worry thoughts. And it could be so many different triggers. You know, it could be school, it could be family, it could be work. For me, as a high school student, I got very anxious before going into my science class. And just the worry thoughts would then activate my stress response. I'd start to feel different in my body. I'd start to feel the rapid heartbeat. I'd start to feel stomach ache. And before you know it, I was in fight, flight, or freeze in that classroom, you know, and all I was thinking about was, please don't call on me because I have no idea what you're talking about. And that preoccupied the space in my brain versus having some strategies to calm myself in those moments so that I could actually take the information in. I was trying to avoid that threat, which I thought was, oh my gosh, I can't have the wrong answer, or I'm going to feel humiliated in front of my whole class.
Mm, yeah, it was algebra for me, but I remember the physiological stress reaction of getting hot, having the hair on the back of your neck stand up. I think everybody feels that even, you know, once or twice in a school kind of environment. The interesting thing, though, is you ended up working in neuroscience or being connected to it and using it in your work. So you found a way to overcome that stress reaction to science as a subject.
Well, it's so funny you say that, because that, I think, is a great example of that connection of emotion and learning. So for me, the science was a threat for a long time, and I wasn't really seeing the relevance of the science in my life at that time. And I honestly, at that point in my life, I was in a state of anxiety, and I was kind of bored too at the same time. And that was a revelation for me, was that boredom could be something that could actually activate the stress response. But I found a way, certainly through being an educator, but also when my son had his post-concussion syndrome diagnosis, all of a sudden I had personal relevance to science. And then I just started seeing all these applications of how we could use this in education, in work, in sports, in life, in relationships. There were just so many applications of how to use the neuroscience to our advantage, and we weren't using it. Well, I don't want to say everybody, but a lot a lot of us weren't. And to this day, there's a big gap between what we know to be true versus what is actually being implemented in the classroom as far as instructional practices and just what parents are aware of.
That you mentioned creating low threat activities, creating a low threat environment. What does that mean in practice for educators? What does it mean to take away that threat for students?
So thank you for that question. That can look like activities that I'm going to call them retrieval practices, and that's not my term. But a practice that, for example, a quick write or a quick draw, something that you could do some thinking on paper about a concept or some vocabulary or anything that you were just taught, and you write down some thoughts about it, or you do a drawing in response to it. And these are activities that just take about, say, 2 to 3 minutes, and then it's something you could share with a partner. So we know that the brain likes collaboration, and these kinds of activities, you're doing all the thinking, the teacher's not doing the thinking. Another one that's quick is a brain dump. So you could just write down, like, say, for example, after this discussion, we just wrote down everything that we just learned. Anything at all that comes to mind, there's really no wrong answer. And then you would share that with somebody, you know, a partner in your classroom. So those kinds of things now are very effective for learning and low on the stress. Now, there has to be that psychological safety piece too at the same time. If they're in an environment where they're not feeling respected or valued or safe that they could make a mistake, then their guard might be up. Or let's say I use, you know, that term quick write. If kids don't like to write, they might be like, ugh. But once you tell them, oh, you don't have to write complete sentences for this, you can just write down some thoughts, you know, and some bullets, you'll have kids start to write. And before you know it, within a couple of weeks, I have kids writing sentences and paragraphs. So you start with these kind of low threat kinds of activities that are not graded. And another great benefit for the teachers is they don't have to, you know, put more time into grading as well. It's more about getting your ideas out in real time, sharing them, and then, you know, clarifying. There can be those opportunities. Let's say that I wrote down something that wasn't correct, or I misinterpreted a fact or a concept. There's that opportunity to clarify it. Instead of, like, for example, one of my sons, without these kinds of strategies, he was writing songs in his head for a good part of the class, but he wasn't a behavior problem. So he'd be looking at the teacher and nodding his head, you know, as if he was agreeing with every comment she made, yet he was just kind of going along to the rhythm in his head. And she thought he was really paying attention. And it wasn't until test time, say a week after these concepts were introduced, that the teacher realized, oh, he really wasn't with me. And so those kinds of things can help sooner than later to kind of clarify some misunderstandings, and you get to see in real time what the kids are taking away.
And thinking about the stress put on students, there's two things I think about, especially right now, of course. One is that students are scheduled within an inch of their life a lot of the time, especially at that secondary level, but even younger learners. And we also know that the environment for many students has completely changed, or is at least new in a few ways. What are your thoughts on the effect of that, and what are your thoughts on how educators can counteract the stress that comes out of those changes?
So certainly it's a year like we've never experienced before, and lots of changes going on. And unfortunately, this is causing an increase in stress for many students and parents and teachers as well. In one of my recent trainings that I just did with about 200 teachers, 90% of them, or really over 90%, reported an increase in stress in their lives, and they reported the same for their kids and for the parents of their students. So if we think about that and that connection of emotion to learning, we know that if there's an increase of stress, and of course we all need some stress for us to get up each day and for us to compete, but when we get out of that sweet spot of stress and it's too much stress or it's chronic stress, that is going to interfere with our ability to learn, you know, our ability to teach, our ability to have good social interactions, and it's going to affect our behavior. So what I'm hearing from teachers is they're concerned that they might not be able to cover as much. They're feeling that it's harder to go at the same pace with virtual learning. They're certainly putting in a lot of extra hours. Many are dealing with hybrid, some dealing with traditional classrooms, some dealing with distance learning, and these things are kind of ever-changing. So teachers are constantly adapting, as are the parents and the students. And then if you think about a lot of teachers, they're parents too. So many of them might be working from home at the same time that their kids are working from home. So I feel like, you know, we know that stress is contagious. So for students and their parents and teachers, I think there is this contagious effect. And we have to be mindful that with distance learning, it does take more self-direction on the student's end. And it does take, let's say, better developed executive function skills. And kids need to be, you know, rested, fed, watered, ready to go in a good working space, on time, with the proper materials. And for some kids, that's a challenge. It's harder for teachers to pick up on nonverbal cues and read the room. And it's harder to build relationships and get to know new people online. And, you know, some kids are having trouble with the technology, or they might not be finding the lessons or the assignments clear. Some kids are embarrassed by their home backgrounds and they don't want their video cameras on. Sometimes we're looking at black screens and we don't know, is that person paying attention or there? So there's a lot of other stressors, not to mention we're all on screens a lot more. And some of us might be getting less movement time, which isn't a great thing. So a lot of things for us to be mindful of with the distance learning. It's not all bad, of course, but there are some new challenges and you know, some things we have to be very, very mindful of.
So if I'm an educator and I know moving forward, I want to be keeping these things front of mind. I want to be integrating a mindset that recognizes these stressors. Where should I go? What should I be thinking about? What should I be doing to kind of get myself in the right mindset?
So that's a great question. I would revisit the idea of building that psychologically safe environment, because if we expect kids to do well academically and socially, I feel this needs to be a top priority, and that the academics will follow if kids are feeling safe and supported, and if they're in environments where they feel they can trust this environment. There's this environment of respect, and there's some enthusiasm for learning and some curiosity for learning. And I think it would be really helpful if we all became more brain literate. For teachers, for parents, and students to understand how the stress response works, and to teach kids how stress impacts learning and gets in the way of their behavior and their ability to remember. And, you know, we can think of times maybe, you know, you hear about stress anxiety or kids blanking out for a test. It's a real thing. You know, in those moments, their memory was impaired and their executive function went offline. So I think having that awareness is helpful, and to start to notice your worried thoughts, start to notice how your body feels. Those are signs that we're getting stressed, and we can start to catch ourselves when we're triggered, and we can actually interrupt the stress response if we're really paying attention. In my book, ABC Worry Free, I developed a strategy called the ABC strategy, and that involves three steps. A is accept how you feel. And very often we might beat ourselves up or dismiss how we feel. But if we accept it, that can actually lower the stress down a notch. And the B step is about taking slow, deep breaths. So breathing. And the slow, deep breaths send a message to the nervous system to slow the game down. And that helps us reset so we can get in a better emotional state. And then the C step is about changing our thinking. So let's say, for example, I have to accept at that A step that mistakes make me very anxious. And I might be thinking mistakes are bad. I might change that to mistakes help me learn, or mistakes are part of the learning process. And that kind of, let's say, more productive way or new perspective about mistakes is going to keep me in a calmer state. So I'll have better opportunities to learn. So I think having some strategies at our disposal, whether I'm a teacher, parent, or student, to help us calm ourselves is going to be helpful. Other things we can do is in our communication. Sometimes we might use language that sends messages of catastrophic thinking or permanence, and that things will never change. And I think it's really important for us to almost normalize change. And of course, we would be anxious using a new platform. Let's say you're using Zoom for the first time. So of course, that might be uncomfortable. And just kind of validating and normalizing these changes and how we're feeling about it. And also normalizing how we look at mistakes, right? Are we sending messages about perfection or about improvement? Are we sending language that's using mistakes to inform and guide us for the next time? Or are we thinking about mistakes as a really bad thing? So I think those are just some things we can do. And I also love using check-in charts where we kind of gauge the social and emotional climate of either the distance learning or the traditional learning space, because that teaches kids and adults self-awareness and how to self-monitor themselves so that they know they can do something to make them feel better. And those are great skills for life.
Yeah, it's good to know that in those situations, there are tools in the box that we can reach for.
Exactly. You know, and about the piece I was mentioning about being brain literate, helping kids to learn about neuroplasticity and how your brain continues to grow and change based on how you used it. And we could all say that we've had to adapt a lot over the last 7 months or so. And we've all experienced neuroplasticity in action. You know, like just take, for example, using Zoom. I had to up my Zoom game and do some training and practice, and I made a lot of mistakes along the way. And I think sharing this with students, you know, sharing our vulnerabilities and how we're going through these changes together and how we can do things to make us feel better when we are feeling stressed, for kids to know there's something they can do and that they can make positive change, I think is really empowering.
Okay, friends, we are out of time for this meeting, but if you'll stay in your digital seats for just a few more minutes, we'll cover our homework, and that is go check out the links, the show notes, and the description for this episode of the podcast. There you'll find links to videos that Noelle's put together that give you tips on managing stress and anxiety, and hey, we could always use a few more techniques. Keep up with the latest from TCEA. We've got tons of events, webinars, courses, and certifications that you can take advantage of now to boost your skills. The best way to do it is, of course, follow us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest. Go look for TCEA. And keep up to date by subscribing to the podcast and rate and review. It really does help us out. And of course, if you want to earn some extra credit, don't forget to send your thoughts, ideas, suggestions, and whatever else you have to say to podcast@tcea.org. And that's it. I could overwhelm you with even more information, but I think it's a good time to stop and take a deep breath. Did you do it? Well, good. You're probably feeling better already. And so with our moods slightly improved, I will say thanks for joining us for this meeting of the EdTech Club, and be sure to join us next week for another meeting. Until then, I'm Andrew Rausch. Thanks for being part of the club. EdTech Club is a production of TCEA. To learn more and to join, go to tcea.org.